It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a state lawmaker wants to help college students lighten their debt load. His plan, coming up later this hour.
Now, before the news, we were talking about how today marks the 50th anniversary or birthday of the G.I. Joe. I call them dolls. You call them action figures. Turns out you're right. G.I. Joe is known as the world's first action figure. So I'll give you that one, Rob. And we want to know now about your favorite classic toys. Maybe G.I. Joe is one that you played with. What do you remember fondly when you look back at your childhood? What are those memories spent whiled away with a Light Bright, an Etch-a-Sketch? Mr. Potato Head, tell us what your memories are and why you love that particular toy. Did you still keep it? Is it a collectible? You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. We're taking your calls right now. It's 1-800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Is there a toy that you played with as a kid that maybe you are passing on to your kids or looking forward to doing so? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You are our guest at 800-642-1234. One of my classics has to be the Legos, and that's one that my kids, actually more so than I ever did, my kids went nuts and they'd play with them, put them away for a while, pull them back out over a 7-8 year span and still going strong.
Now that is a classic-y classic toy, yeah. Because Legos are, they still have the stature they did pretty much when we were growing up, if not more so. So they've really survived the test of time. Other toys, not so much. The game Operation I really loved, but I don't think you can buy it anymore, can you?
I think it still exists in, I think they've come up with some themes to it. I think there was a Simpsons Operation or something like that. So, yeah, where you could operate on Homer, maybe pull out a beer can. I don't know.
So there's some mods.
Well, let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234, sharing your favorite classic toys. We've got Dan to start us off in Wisconsin Dells. Dan, hi.
How you doing?
Good. What's your toy?
Well, my toy was an Evel Knievel. It was a motorcycle, and you would, I don't know how to describe it, but you would put it on this little,
like a little launcher?
And you would wind it up, and then it would take off like crazy. And I was on eBay one day, and I found one for $40, so I bid on it, but it went up to $400.
Oh,
whoa.
So it must be a classic toy. And one of my favorite stories about that is I got the Evel Knievel motorcycle. My cousin John got the same one. My cousin Dave got the Rocket, which was the bummer. He cried.
Oh, poor Dave. He got the bum toy. All right. Well, thank you so much, Dan, for calling and sharing. I haven't heard of the Evel Knievel motorcycle. Do you know that one?
I don't. I remember my favorite pinball machine when I was a kid was the Evel Knievel pinball machine. I was never very good at pinball in any incarnation, but I love that one. I love that one.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. Nick is joining us next in Madison. Hi, Nick.
Hey, how you doing? Big G.I. Joe guy. You know, you didn't really, there wasn't a thing as an action figure. G.I. Joe was all there was. There was G.I. Joe, Barbie, and Ken. You know, that was about all there was. So you just played G.I. Joes with your friends. And at first, he just had painted on hair, but somewhere in the later 60s, he had lifelike hair.
Oh.
Kind of little like, and it was cool, and a beard and a mustache. And one time, we would pull him behind our bikes on a little plastic car. And one time he flipped over and I didn't know it, so I dragged him for quite a while.
Oh.
And it wore off the hair on his chin, and he had this really cool, like, sculpted, like, Fu Manchu mustache. I was super into G.I. Joe. Those were great times of my life.
Nick, thanks a lot for sharing that. And that would have been the taller G.I. Joes, not the shorter ones that I played with. They kind of did a whole revamp of the G.I. Joe line.
I see.
For
and
my
did,
era.
Did yours have the alterable facial hair?
I never tried to that extent. I never tried to sculpt that special mustache on.
All right. Thanks a lot, Nick. And let's go to Brian in Clear Lake. Hi, Brian.
Yes, I'm calling to remind people of the 2-foot-tall Mr. T doll.
Oh.
That's what I had.
Oh, fun.
And was that a favorite of yours?
Oh, I loved it so much I kept it on the shelf. I went to play with it. He was an idol of mine. I dressed up like him for Halloween and wore jewelry around and thought he was the best. And then they had the TV show on, you know, the A-Team.
The A-Team,
he was on that.
I pity the fool who wouldn't enjoy the Mr. T toy, Brian.
What came first, the TV show or the Mr. T doll? It was Mr. T around before the TV show?
I'm sure it must have been after because, you know, after all the fame started to pick up, they would make the figures, I suppose, after the fact. But I treasure that. I don't even know what happened to it, but eventually I stopped wearing the jewelry and stopped affecting the mannerisms of them. But still in,
it's probably for the best.
I listen for him on TV, and every now and then he pops up. But he's still a hero of mine in a way. He's got a strong moral character, and he was a good guy.
All right, a plug for Mr. T there. It's fun to think about him again. It's been a long time. Mm. Thank you so much, Brian. And let's go next to Timothy joining us in Colfax. Hi, Timothy.
Hello. I've got something that I'm sure nobody else was going to bring up. It was a game, or it was a box that had a bunch of figures. It was called the Wagon Train Set. That used to be a television program back in the 1950s. In fact, we were watching Wagon Train on a Wednesday night in June of 1958 when the disastrous tornado went through Colfax. And that was something I had lots of hours playing with the wagons and the horses and all the pioneers as well as the native, the Indians that were also coming on horses.
And Timothy, what happened to the set?
Well, a friend of where I used to watch television, we didn't have a television back in the 50s, and her nephew wanted that set. And so I reluctantly sold it away. And then years later, I talked to his mom, and she had just gotten rid of it at a rummage sale. So if anybody has it out there someplace, I would love to get that set back.
All right. Well, get in touch with us on Central Time. We'll try to track you down, Timothy, and if somebody has that set, hopefully it can make its way back to you. Thanks for sharing that Wagon Train memory and the tornado memory. That's a profound toy experience. We'll go now to Mary in Chaseburg. Mary, hi.
Hi. My favorite toy was my sister and I. We used to play jacks all the time. I don't know if you guys remember them.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we used to sit for hours, and I'm trying to teach my grandchildren, but take some coordination.
Yeah, definitely. My problem with jacks, Mary, is when my kids had them, they never all got put away, and I might be walk through the house without all the lights up high, and well, you know what comes next? You step on a jack. They're really painful.
Yeah, that's true.
They are worse than Legos to step on.
Oh, yeah.
That's for sure.
Yes, they are. But we have many, many hours. I have seven brothers and four sisters. And
wow.
We used to all get together, and that's what we'd have many tournaments.
Oh, that sounds fun.
Did you ever win, Mary?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, well, we'd do it from hours, though.
All right. Thanks a lot for sharing that, Mary.
I'm surprised no one's. We've had a lot of G.I. Joe calls. Haven't had any Barbie calls yet. I had a lot of Barbies. I don't know if I would say I was, really attached to them, but I definitely dragged them around the block and smashed them into earthworms and things like that. But it's lots of different fun to have with the toys. Lots of different uses that the manufacturers never intended. Well, happy birthday, G.I. Joe. 50 years today.
Thanks to all of you for sharing your calls, your favorite toy memories. Keep it going on the Central Time Facebook page. We're Central Time on WPR.
Coming up, we'll be talking about a plan to lighten the debt load for Wisconsin students. First, here's a look at some of the latest news with Kristen Durst. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, we'll learn how police recruits determine if someone has had too much to drink. One of our producers signed up as a volunteer for field sobriety training with police officers learning the job. She'll share her experience.
First, a bill in the state legislature aims to reduce the burden of student debt in Wisconsin. And according to the authors, the legislation would be the first of its kind in the nation.
The bill would allow Wisconsin citizens to refinance their student loan debt and receive a tax deduction on their repayments. The authors of the bill held a public hearing yesterday, which drew a packed house of both supporters and critics questioning the bill's effectiveness.
Joining us now is one of the authors of the bill, Dave Hansen, Democratic State Senator from Green Bay. Senator Hansen, welcome to the show.
Well, it's great to be on.
Well, let's talk about your plan and how it came about. Why do you think this is needed right now?
Well, first of all, we were overwhelmed by the support yesterday. And in fact, 19 people testified in favor. 3 only for information only, 53 registered in favor, no one registered as opposed. So they may have had some questions, but Many more also provided written submissions. So we're very excited about that, and we have another hearing on Monday in the Assembly. We're just hoping we're headed in the right direction to really do something good for the state of Wisconsin and grow our economy.
What kinds of perspectives did you hear at the hearing?
Well, what I've noted, and it was so crowded I couldn't stay for the whole thing, but basically there's a real problem out there. There are 753,000 Wisconsinites with an average debt of $27,000, a lot of people with a lot more, and it takes 18 and a half years to pay it off, so we're talking about $400 a month. And one of the saddest things I've just seen recently, the federal government in the last 6 years made $66 billion on the backs of the students, and it's projected in the next 10 years they're going to get another $185 billion. So that is what's causing, I think, a downturn in the economy, and young people that got into it, who are now getting older, are really stuck for a long, long time with a lot of debt.
Now, we've been hearing about how student debt is a problem in all states, but how extensive is it in Wisconsin?
Well, like I say, 753,000 people that we know about that are with the public debt, but there are private loans out there that we're not aware of. So we're just trying. I think the key thing is we'd be the first state in the country. We would be the pioneer. Other states have seen what we're trying to do, and they're looking for a copy of our bill. And I know in Washington, D.C., the Democratic U.S. senators have been looking at it and saying, this is just absolutely wrong. And, people go get into education, tech schools, colleges, they think they're doing the right thing, and they end up with such terrible, terrible debt. And if we could remove some of that, we could really, truly grow our economy.
Now, the primary feature of the bill is to let students refinance their loans at lower interest rates through a new body called the Wisconsin Student Loan Refinancing Authority. Can you run us through how that would work?
Well, it would be modeled after our Wisconsin Housing and Economic Development Authority. There would be bonding authority. And basically, we would buy up the loans and allow the students, if they chose, the option of taking a lower rate. And we understand there's people out there yesterday that I met 6%, 8%, and maybe some private loans a lot higher than that in double digits. And the chairperson of the committee asked, well, what if, they already have a low rate? We wouldn't make anybody take a higher rate. The idea is to take a higher rate and put more money in the economy so people would have the opportunity to refinance like they can for an automobile or for a home at a lower rate, where they could maybe buy a home rather than rent and buy a new car rather than a used car. So it's, and I think we've got a lot of interest and a lot of support because it is truly a huge issue.
Now, as you said, people who have mortgages, people who buy a car, they are allowed to refinance, certainly mortgages. Why do you think it has, I guess, taken this long to see legislation like this be proposed?
Obviously, tuition has been going up at a tremendous rate, except for the last few years now, where we've been able to put into the future, a tuition freeze, which is a good thing. And, they've talked a lot about in the state capitol providing parents and grandparents the opportunity to provide money in EdVest. But we're talking about students that are stuck, and really stuck, with $300, $400, $500 a month for 18 or 19 years. That's money that's not being spent in the economy, and the federal government is just making oodles and oodles of money. So we'd like to change that, the ability to refinance a loan, as well as a tax deduction. People could be saving a lot of money and growing the economy as a result.
Are you seeing any kind of opposition to it so far?
Well, the Republicans, we fought real hard. A Senate organization that I'm in, and on the floor of the state Senate, I kept asking for a hearing, and lo and behold, we got the hearing. But that's no guarantee that something's going to pass. We have our hopes. If they'd like to tweak it a little bit, that's fine. But really, we see this as a major problem in our state, and our ability, for our residents to be able to refinance and have more money to spend is just an unbelievable opportunity.
What are the concerns of the Republicans that you've spoken with?
Well, one of the things, one of the local bankers said it was about security in the loan. Well, if you know anything about a student loan, it's what they call non-dischargeable debt. So when you're bankrupt, guess what? That loan stays with you, does not go away. When you die, it's still with your estate. So it's like one of the toughest debts ever to get rid of. And I talked to the Chancellor of Green Bay recently, and he said it's one of the best loans out there. Our default rate in Madison, I understood, was like 1% statewide, about 7%. But this is a loan that's going to be with you, so it has to be paid. you know, I don't know if they can actually take your income taxes, your wages. I'm guessing they can if you are in default. So this is a loan that will never go away. You must pay it, and it just leaves you short on funds to buy all the other things that could grow our economy.
Now, you mentioned a tax deduction. How would that work?
Well, the tax deduction, as it's set up, could be up to, I believe it's somewhere around $7,000, where the loan and the interest could be deducted from your income tax. You know, and some people say it's double dipping or whatever, but the parents usually take, you know, the credit when the kids are going to school. So when they're out of school, it's the graduates that have to pay for it. And so we feel that's an opportunity. You could get as much, you could save as much as $1,000 a year, you know, with a higher debt, and maybe down to about $500, but $1,000 for a married couple, that would be money good, also good for the economy. So the tax deduction and the ability to have your rate reduced, and there's just a couple other features, more information for borrowers about their rights and responsibilities, and much better tracking of student loan debt information. We don't think we have enough information except what's been reported about the $753,000.
Well, we're talking with Wisconsin lawmaker Dave Hansen right now about his higher ed lower debt bill, and you can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. What do you think? Is it a good idea to let college graduates refinance their student loans and sometimes lower the cost? I guess in the plan, always lower the cost if it works as we're hearing. What do you think about that? Would it help ease the burden? Or do you think there is not enough security to do that, as some Republicans have voiced concerns? 1-800-642-1234. And you also talk about how this bill would address brain drain in Wisconsin. Brain drain. Can you talk about that?
Actually, if a young person would come into Wisconsin and establish residency, they would be able to get a refinancing. So we have an opportunity to bring people back. You know, we always hear about the brain drain, people leaving the state. This would be an opportunity to gain some of the quality people coming back, hopefully creating jobs, money in the economy. And that's one of the things I think we've been lacking in our state with the job loss, is the consumers don't have a real amount of money to spend. And, you know, you can talk all you want about public employees taking a hit, but they did. And I think that may be one of the reasons, and the student debt is another, that we've not been able to grow the economy in our state like maybe Minnesota and other states.
Well, let's get some of our listeners in on this. We've got Allison on the line from Green Bay. Hi, Allison.
Hi, Allison.
Hi, how's it going? Thanks for taking my call.
What do you think about this? Do you think it's a good idea?
I am a huge advocate of any ways that can help students with their debt. I am not originally from Wisconsin. I moved here about 2.5 years ago from the East Coast, and I went to two small private liberal arts colleges, took all my student debt in my own name, not in my parents' name, and I have an undergraduate in economics and a master's in public administration, 6 figures of debt, and I work for a nonprofit. So I am the token kid graduating with too much debt that can't get hired in the field that they wanted to work in. And I love my job, and I'm actually thrilled about the Federal Loan Public Servant Loan Forgiveness Act, where you can have a portion of your debt forgiven after 10 years in the public service. But it's a great point that I'm not contributing much to the economy because I'm, you know, I'm about to turn 26 years old, and I still live with my parents, and I do not have much money after I pay for my health insurance and my student loans every month.
All right. Well, Allison, thank you so much for calling and sharing your situation with us. And does this sound typical of what you're hearing, Senator Hansen?
Very typical. We could. We had some dentists in my office recently, dental students actually from Marquette. Their debt could approach $300,000 to $400,000, and any little bit of help for them would be greatly appreciated. And I think Allison's a really good case, someone that went out and did everything right. We had a bad downturn in the economy, and now she's facing six-figure debt. And the high interest rate, if we could get that lowered, would do a lot of good to help her. And a tax deduction, not a lot of money, but I'm sure any little bit would help, and the opportunity for her to progress in her life.
All right, let's see if we have time for one more call before the news. Eric is joining us from Amory. Hi, Eric.
Hi, Eric. I have a similar situation to Ashley. Actually, it's my wife, but she's got a lot of debt. She's a social worker, and a lot of her debt is in private loans. You briefly mentioned private loans. Would they also qualify under this bill?
The private loans would, because, you know, I mean, if you had a lot of equity in a private loan, you may be able to get refinanced. But I'm thinking if you've got a lot of private debt at a high rate, it's going to be very, very difficult. She would qualify as a resident. We would make that attempt to refinance and something more in the area of a 3 or 4%. I know some of the private debt, I don't know where your wife's debt is, but they could be in double digits. And, you know, it is hard, you know, for people to have that opportunity for the American dream. They did all the things right. And now they're just stuck with so much debt that, you know, they have the opportunity, if we can help them out, to grow the economy and make a difference.
We are talking with Wisconsin lawmaker Dave Hansen about his higher ed lower debt bill. And we'd love to hear from you on this at 1-800-642-1234. We'll keep going after the news. Are you someone who's struggling with student debt? Do you feel like the ability to refinance and receive tax deductions for repayments would be helpful? Or do you see dangers that should be considered, like the security issue? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can also send an email to talk@wpr.org.
We'll pick up a conversation after this news from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret with Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Democratic State Senator Dave Hansen. We're talking about his higher ed lower debt bill. You can join in at 800-642-1234. As he's told us, the ability to refinance and receive tax deductions for loan repayments would be part of the bill. Would that be helpful to you? Do you think it's a good idea or a bad idea? 800-642-1234.
And let's go to the phones now. We have Clinton joining us from Milwaukee County. Hi, Clinton.
Hello.
What do you think?
I'll tell you what I think. This is a bad idea. It's a bad idea because it's a more perpetuation of a scam. I'm a 61-year-old disabled male. I've been victimized by the student loan laws. This scam is doing nothing but helping the bankers get their money instead of addressing the real fundamental problems.
Which
For example, as it pertains to disabled people, the student loans are not dismissible under any circumstances, as Mr. Hansen pointed out. That's part of the fundamental problem in itself.
Okay.
Now what they've done is they've changed the law, and people should be aware that if they're on Social Security disability, that is now recognized as a way to have your loans forgiven. However, that went into effect July 1st of this year. Now what they've done, and the state of Wisconsin is going to want their tax money, they taxed me for the student loans, which I feel is fair because I received the money as income. However, what's a scam about it is they're taxing me on the interest that would have been collected by the bill collectors.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Clinton. Clinton's skeptical about this, talking about there need to be more opportunities to have loans completely dismissed, and he is on disability as well. But I want to, before you respond, Senator Hansen, to Clinton, I want to read a comment on Facebook as well that dovetails a little bit with this. John on Facebook says, this is, of course, in lieu of studying the funding of higher education and why it costs so much to go to college now compared to as recently as the 70s. So are we kind of, with this bill, working on the back end of the problem instead of the cause?
I think the problem's there, and the cause hopefully can be worked on by maintaining the levels of tuition. And in an infinite wisdom in past budget, you know, the UW system was cut a lot, and they felt they had to raise the tuition. Now it's being held in line a little bit more. You know, it's a problem. Back when I went to school in many, many years ago, late 60s, early 70s, I think my semester tuition was like $115. So that is a major problem. But the fact is, all these people are out there with a lot of debt, and we have to do whatever we can to help them. You know, and I heard on your news broadcast somebody saying, well, you know, that means they're going to try to get more debt. I think people are going to plan better, understanding what the future is and what the opportunities are, that they hope that their education is a ticket to a good future. And if they see it as something else, maybe they will get into an apprenticeship or a trade or something else. They're going to be more broad in what they're looking at. But I think it's backward thinking to say that we can't help these people, especially with the kind of profit that's being made at the federal level.
All right. Well, Clinton, thank you for that phone call. And we go next to Alex in Milwaukee. Hi, Alex.
Hey, Alex.
Hi. How are you doing?
Good.
My question, I guess, would be, on these loans, for example, I have a subsidized loan as well as an unsubsidized loan amounting roughly to around $10,000 in student loans. I graduated in 2010. I was wondering, is there going to be a limit on, for example, how much you're making that you would qualify to refinance your loan? Or does it matter if you're making, let's say, 90 grand a year, right? Well, how would that work?
I don't believe any income limit would be put on it. It would just give you the opportunity, the option, to have a lower rate on your student loan. And the cap, I think, as far as tax deduction, even if you had a real big student loan, I think a married couple could get like $1,000 total. So.
All right. Thank you for that call, Alex. Appreciate it. And Senator Hansen, have you explored at all adding to this different scenarios in which debt would be forgiven or dismissed?
Well, some of the things that have been talked about, you know, with people with doctors and, you know, family docs, and we found out yesterday how expensive and how much debt they have coming out, and fewer and fewer people are getting into family doctoring. You know, the ability of a nurse or a doctor to work in a rural area and get some of their debt removed, that would be another possibility, and some of that's already going on. But here we're trying to be more broad, obviously, and going to the ability to refinance when, like I said, the federal government making $66 billion in 6 years on the backs of students and graduates, to me, is just absolutely wrong.
Let's take another phone call now. We go to Saul in Milwaukee. Hi there. Is this Saul?
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Hi, what do you think about the idea?
Well, I think this is a great idea, and I commend Senator Hansen on authoring this bill. For me, I actually started my college career 7 years ago, and my family couldn't afford tuition even at a state university, and so I had to rely on financial aid and student loans to pay for it. But that wasn't enough. And so 2 years into my college career, I actually had to drop out and join the Army to get the GI Bill so that I could go to school. And so from 2010 to 2013, I was in the military. I was deployed to Afghanistan. And while I was in Afghanistan, I had to make payments on my student loans because my loans lacked any common sense consumer protections for me while I was deployed. And so this bill would provide so much help to students across the state in dealing with the mountain of debt that they come out with.
So while you're serving in Afghanistan, you're paying student loans?
Yes.
So thank you so much for sharing your story with us. Senator Hansen, what do you think when you hear a story like that?
Well, that's a great story, and I think that's what it's all about, you know, helping people like that. And Saul's a great example. You know, it's about providing opportunity and also providing freedom to get that education that you need to move forward and grow and help us grow the economy. So, you know, you can make a lot of arguments that people are going to get more student loans because we're going to try to get a lower interest rate. I think that's a bogus argument.
Let's go to one last caller here. We have Mia with us from Madison. Hi, Mia.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you think about the idea?
Oh, my gosh. I just want to, first of all, thank the Senate committee for taking up this bill. I was actually at the hearing yesterday at the Capitol, and I'm a junior here at UW-Madison. I will be graduating with $30,000 in student loan debt, and I, for a long time, since I was a little girl, have wanted to go to law school. And it's very scary that, unfortunately, because I have so much debt from undergrad, that although I still plan to go to law school, that I'm going to be swamped in debt even after, you know, I graduate from law school because it's $50,000 a year. And so having a bill like this for me to be able to refinance my loans after I graduate from law school would be fantastic and help me so much. And I think it's really important that students who have these dreams of going on to professional schools, like becoming a doctor, becoming a lawyer, their dreams aren't deferred because of student loans and how shackling it can be. So I know personally for me, as someone who's aspiring to be a lawyer, this bill would be very, very helpful for me.
Well, Mia, thank you so much. Appreciate you calling in. And Senator Hanson, Mia, at the hearing yesterday, she's in support of this. What is next for the bill?
Well, the assembly hearing on Monday, and hopefully both committees will have an exec, which is a vote, and then get to the floor of the Senate and the assembly and allow these young people that want to be a lawyer or a doctor or learn a skilled trade, you know, that opportunity to live their American dream.
Well, Senator Hanson, thank you so much for joining us today.
I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
We've been speaking with Dave Hanson, a Democratic state senator from Green Bay.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. For Wisconsin law enforcement officers, administering field sobriety tests to determine if someone is drunk driving or not is an all too common occurrence.
While veteran officers may become well-versed in administering these tests, new recruits need to get that experience somewhere.
And for that, they turn to volunteer drinkers. Officers practice standardized field sobriety tests on volunteers, and the drinks are in the house.
Deanna Riley is with us. She's a traffic specialist with the Madison Police Department. She's one of several trainers who help new police recruits determine if someone's had too much to drink. Deanna, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
And also along with us is our very own Cynthia Schuster. She was a volunteer drinker in a training session last week. Cynthia, welcome to the other side of Central Time.
Yeah, good to be here.
Well, Officer Riley, the Madison Police Department providing free drinks. How did that come about?
Actually, Madison Police Department is one of the three employer-based academies in the state. We have our own law enforcement academy, and this curriculum is actually part of the 520 that the Department of Justice requires all law enforcement academies to have. So the three state academies, Madison Police, Milwaukee, and Wisconsin State Patrol, as well as all the technical colleges, run law enforcement academies where this SFST training is required as part of the curriculum to become a certified law enforcement officer.
So a volunteer comes in. How do you know how much you're going to serve to them, first of all, before you start testing out the tests?
We have a basic chart that we're given from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, and it breaks it down by gender and by weight. And then it gives us some guidance as far as how many ounces to get them to a certain BAC or blood alcohol concentration. So we use that as our guide and our chart, and we go from there asking some preliminary questions of our drinkers as to how frequently they drink, and we ask them typically to come on an empty stomach so that they can absorb that alcohol quicker for us.
Well, we have audio of a volunteer getting results of a test. We'll get into how these tests work in a minute. And the rest of the volunteers are listening in. Let's hear what happened there.
And our king of the night here.
Yeah.
TC 0.107, 0.104, 0.087, and your final one just now was 0.098.
What?
In spite of the fact that you did 22 ounces.
So sort of a weird Olympic event, sort of. You're seeing the scores from the judges come up there. Okay, so they've done the drinking. What kind of tests then do the police trainees run?
We have them perform the standard field sobriety test, which is the horizontal gaze nystagmus test. It's where we're looking for the eye to jerk as it's moving side to side. We have them perform a walk and turn test, which is 9 steps down a line, turn around in a prescribed fashion, and return back 9 heel to toe steps. And the third of those three is the one-leg stand. They're also taught some alternate tests that they may throw in there as well, just to get some experience and exposure to those on impaired people.
And then we were hearing people's blood alcohol levels with a breathalyzer, I assume?
Yes, we use a preliminary breath test unit.
And is this part of the thing being trained, or is that to gauge how well the officers did in assessing intoxication?
We use it in twofold. One, to make sure that we as the dosers are getting them to a level that we are trying to obtain. We don't want anyone to get too high on their alcohol level. But also it helps to let the officers get some feedback at the end of the night, how they did in their decisions to arrest or not arrest these volunteers.
We'll get into more of what they learn in a bit. But Cynthia Schuster, let's bring you in on this. You were a volunteer drinker. What was that experience like, having the police have you drink for testing?
Yeah, well, I had never heard of this until I did the Citizens Academy. I thought, well, that makes sense. These officers need to learn on a live subject in, you know, ideally a safe environment. So it was interesting to be a part of that. They ask you what you want to drink, and you tell them, and you can even name a brand, and they'll provide it if it's possible. And last year, I did this. This is my second year. The last year I did it, I was an over, meaning I elected to be someone who would drink above the limit. And this year I was an under. Last year, I did not tell them how much I weighed. I just assumed that they would weigh me. And I wound up getting a lot of alcohol as a result. I don't know if they were eyeballing me and thinking I had a high tolerance, but that was an interesting experience. This time it was a little bit more tame.
So you drank, and then as we heard, they did the test, the walk in a straight line and looking at your eyes. Even though you hadn't just gotten out of a car driving, was it a nerve-wracking experience to have police having you walk the line there?
Yeah, it was. It is nerve-wracking. And then you have two or three officers surrounding you as well. This is a team effort. And you go through six or seven rounds, if I'm counting properly, because every group gets a chance with several different volunteers. So by the end of the night, I'm pretty tired, especially when I've come off from working the Joy Cardine show at 5 in the morning. So heel-to-toe thing is difficult for me, even when I'm sober. I mean, just trying to maintain your balance and not weeble wobble too much. Mm-hmm. So imagine trying to do that after you've been fed a few ounces of gin.
And then, Deanna, let's get into how police take the data, their observations of how Cynthia, someone like Cynthia, walks and her eye reaction. How are they reading that? How do they learn how to assess the intoxication of a person based on that visual evidence?
Well, through research, we've learned what we should expect to see for standardized clues. This program's been around since the 70s and actually became part of Wisconsin's training in the mid-1980s. We've been using it ever since here. So we have learned through research and replication of the research that if someone shows four clues on the HGN or the eyes, that we would expect their BACs to be above 0.10 at a certain percentage of the time. Walk and turn, we have standard clues that we look for. If they miss heel to toe, if they raise their arms, if they step offline, if they take an improper turn, all those are different clues that we teach the recruits to look for and help them assess how that individual is doing on those field sobriety tests. And that they can kind of equate towards an impairment level.
Is there a worry that someone might be more nimble than someone else? Cynthia and I might be clumsy and have trouble walking that line sober, and other people might be more agile. Could they outsmart or outfox the system that way?
I wouldn't say outsmart. We do have individuals that are great athletes that have wonderful balance. The thing with the eyes is you can't practice that. You can't prevent your eyes from doing that. So that's why the horizontal gaze nystagmus test is so good for us to check for central nervous system depressants. As far as the others, you know, the recruits always have that question because we're in such a sterile environment. We bring them Cynthia. They don't get to see Cynthia driving. They don't talk to her. They don't get to see anything. They don't get to ask anything. They just presented her and say, do fields. So it is somewhat of a sterile environment and safe environment for them to get an exposure to what we're teaching them in the classroom.
And how quickly do they get better at it? How much of an improvement is there beyond just having them go out and the first time they do it is with the first person they pull over?
We have two nights of the wet workshops is what we call them, and you can see an incredible increase in their confidence from day one, from day two. In day one, they're more concerned about getting their instructions right and that they performed everything correctly. By day two, they're sitting there actually looking at what the drivers or the volunteers are giving them for clues. It's a perishable skill, and if they don't continue to use it, of course, the skill becomes less accurate. And so we always advocate that they're out there utilizing what we've trained them.
Well, obviously, drunk driving, a big problem here in Wisconsin. I assume the Academy does other kinds of training as well. But how big a focus is impaired driving, intoxicated driving at your Academy?
We're lucky enough in our Academy to have the resources, and they expand the program for us. The Department of Justice requires 32 hours. We expand that up to 40 hours and include a special emphasis on drug-impaired drivers as well, since we know that's a huge problem in our city. And we're able to break into small groups, as Cynthia mentioned. We break these down into three groups, or groups of three with an individual instructor per group. So we're lucky here to have the support from our department to give this a high priority in making sure that they're trained accurately and proficiently in these skills.
Cynthia, let's bring you back in and get back into your experience as a volunteer drinker. If you don't mind revealing this information, what were your blood alcohol counts, the time that you were in over maybe and the time you were in under?
This time, they gave me 8 ounces of gin, and my numbers were 0.062, 0.036, 0.029, and 0.026.
Under the legal limit?
Yes.
And did you pass the tests under that?
A couple of people arrested me, mm-hmm. but most passed me.
And in the previous year, do you remember you were over the
I was over, and I don't remember the exact numbers. I want to say it was a 0.13, and then I passed twice.
Wow.
Somehow.
Well, maybe it was their first time doing this, though.
Yeah.
So what did you, Cynthia, take away from this? What did it make you think about our safety on the roads in Wisconsin?
Well, yeah, that's the thing. After I did this last year, I became much more conscientious about how much I drink, and being an over, I was over by the time they measured me the first time. So I don't know what that threshold was. I didn't know when I crossed the legal line, and it just made me more cautious in my own personal life and daily decision making if I were to go out and have a drink with dinner or something like that. This time being an under, too, I was more sober. I was more aware of what the officers were learning and what they're taking into consideration. It was a great learning experience for me, and I continue to take that away with me, too. It just made me a more responsible consumer.
Officer Deanna Riley, in addition to training the officers, it seems like there's maybe some educational material here potentially for the rest of us here to hear about an experience like Cynthia's.
Absolutely. This is, in my opinion, a win-win for everyone. The volunteers learn where their thresholds are. It's interesting. We'll give them half of a dose and ask them halfway through, how do you feel? Would you drive? And the majority say, no, I wouldn't drive. I'm impaired. We give them the second half of their dose to get them over, and by the time they have consumed it all, would you drive? Yeah, I'm fine. Mm. So they learn from how much they've had and how they feel where their limits are, and it's more of an issue of not what is the number, but how do you feel. If you are impaired at an 07, you shouldn't be driving. It doesn't matter what that number is.
If people are interested in doing this, how big a demand is there for volunteer drinkers?
There is academies, and they can check with their technical colleges in their area. Everybody has academies and are required to have these wet workshops. We hold an academy once a year, but I do know tech colleges hold it every three times a year. So their demand is much higher. They could certainly reach out to the law enforcement academies and say that they would like to volunteer to be drinkers. It's always good to get a pair of fresh perspective, not someone that's been through it so that they don't know the tests, and it's good educational tool for those that volunteer as well.
Here's a question maybe everybody out there is thinking. I just thought of it. Did you have a driver, Cynthia?
I did. It was Norman Gilliland.
Ah, WPR's own celebrity designated driver, Norman Gilliland. And Officer Riley, is that a requirement for volunteers, that there's somebody there to drive them home?
Absolutely. We have an agreement that they have to sign before they can be released.
All right. Well, I guess the officers would otherwise get more on-the-job training as everybody's in the parking lot afterward. Well, Officer Riley, thank you so much for being with us and sharing how this training works.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
And Cynthia Schuster, back to work?
Yep.
We've been talking to Officer Deanna Riley. She's a traffic specialist with the Madison Police Department. WPR's Cynthia Schuster was a volunteer drinker in this police field sobriety training exercise. Teaches law enforcement officers how to see if people are drunk when they're out on the road.